Hello, and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Gingery, a senior writer at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by fellow senior writer Sarah Carlin Smith and executive editor Nielsen Hobbs. Today is April 5th, 2024. We're back from spring break, rested and refreshed, and not surprisingly, to another week of interesting pharma and FDA news. First up is the withdrawal of Amylyx's Relyvrio, a treatment that had been approved for ALS. Amylyx announced on April 4th that it would withdraw the drug from the U.S. and Canada after results from the Phoenix trial did not hit primary and secondary endpoints. The product will no longer be available to new patients effective immediately, though, although those already on therapy and who wish to stay on treatment can be transitioned to a free drug program through expanded access. Relyvrio was approved in 2022 based on a single positive phase 2 study and confirmatory data from an open label extension. But one of the interesting parts of the product's regulatory journey was that during an advisory committee meeting on the product, Amylyx executives committed to withdrawing the drug if the trial was not successful. In March, Phoenix was announced as failing to demonstrate statistical significance, which raised the question of whether the company would follow through on its pledge. Now that Amylyx has, our Sue Sutter raised an interesting question. Would the FDA try to use this tactic for other products where there may be questions about efficacy or safety? So Matt and Sarah, obviously public pledges are not binding, as probably just about everyone knows. But do you think this could add another check or whatever you want to call it for sponsors in these cases where, there might be, a lot of lingering questions out there?
Well, it's certainly another arrow in the quiver that regulators have in terms of trying to get sponsors to do what they think they should. As you noted, it's not a true regulatory mechanism. There's no sort of kind of legal teeth behind it. And as we wrote in through kind of as a part of the various coverage of the advisory committee meeting and then through kind of the subsequent announcement there, there is a procedure that FDA can follow that would let them, pull a product from the market that had full approval that a sponsor didn't want to remove, but it is complicated and used, and who knows how it would hold up in court if it really came down to a fight like that. So obviously the public pledge is a great tool to use if FDA feels that they sort of have to go down that their route and don't sort of kind of have the more traditional sort of kind of accelerated approval pathway to sort of keep the sponsor on those sort of has more off ramps to it, and it all comes down to whether the sponsor feels the trial did not meet the criteria versus whether FDA did. So this was not the case. This sort of kind of that there was seems to be sort of a more alignment in terms of sort of kind of what the data showed. But if we're in another situation in which there is a pledge, but then there's some question about the data, it's we'll have to see sort of kind of what value that pledge brings.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit probably risky for FDA in some ways to encourage this moving forward, because this seems like they really almost in some ways got lucky that this was like the best case scenario in terms of how maybe clear cut it was but to the company that I can kind of see this in many cases. We're all sort of used to following advisory committees and drug approvals or potential approvals where FDA and the company have quite different interpretations of the data. And I feel like without that legal accountability, you could get into a lot of public and, sort of fights that don't perhaps reflect well on FDA or the industry necessarily, but I could certainly see FDA in some set ways being having more challenges than a company even that promised to take it off, because you often see patient groups very passionate about wanting access to products regardless of the level of data. I guess the other thing I thought about is there a way that you could sort of formalize something like this through regulations or legislation at Congress in a way that would give companies this option, but also have more protection for the FDA and for the public on the back end to ensure companies really follow through. There's another thought that came to my mind too, is sometimes you get drugs that, you know, change ownership over time and so forth. And, you know, does a pledge of one, you know, CEO or one chief science officer, whoever makes that pledge, you know, what does another ownership entity view their obligation to? So I don't know. I think like to really, if this was to really become something more popular, I would feel like FDA would want like more formal guideposts around it and formalization legally to kind of protect them in some way.
Yeah, that was something that came up, you know, in the story, like, could you write post-marketing requirements to essentially do, you know, do what the what was said in this case, you know, publicly, you know, promised. I don't know if companies would be, you know, all that excited about, you know, agreeing to, you know, something like that where, you know, especially, you know, I mean, it could just be, you know, really take out, you know, extend the negotiations for, you know, all that post-marketing requirements, you know, really extend them. And, you know, do you really want to run up against user fee goals trying to formalize something like that? You know, when you've got a, you know, a million other things you got to do. I also wondered if, you know, you would, I think the if the FDA wants to keep doing this, they would need to be careful about, you know, when they try this, you know, because like you said, Sarah, they got lucky that this was like a ideal scenario where, you know, the public, the pledge was there, the, you know, the data, you know, it clearly didn't meet what, you know, the endpoints. And so they were kind of in this, you know, space to, you know, get to follow through on it. But, you know, the first time you get a public pledge and then they say, well, we don't agree with that. No, then it, you know, you kind of, it loses a lot of its effectiveness. So, you know, I think they, you know, what I think one of the things they had to be careful about is just about how often they try and use it and kind of pick their spots, I guess.
I mean, you'd also probably have to think about too, right? I mean, this was a, I think, sort of a unique drug in a unique disease setting where FDA was willing to give a lot of, you know, flexibility because of, you know, lack of really treatments here for such a devastating disease. So I imagine that they might want to think about some lines too around there, you know, that this kind of flexibility was maybe seen as okay because of, you know, again, I mean, FDA has lots of pathways where the character, where, you know, that rests sort of on certain characteristics around the kind of the disease state and unmet need and so forth. And, you know, it's hard to imagine they'd be okay with this for something like a more common disease where there already are a number of reasonably good treatments and so forth. So, you know, they probably, you know, if they tried to like formalize this concept in any way, I think they'd probably, you know, be most likely to keep it pretty narrow in terms of the types of, you know, disease areas and so forth it might apply to.
We're all excited about things we don't see every day. And, you know, this is one of those. So maybe we'll get to see it a few more times. So, but definitely worth something worth following. Next up is the advisory committee process. There are now potentially, or at least an idea was floated for the panels of outside experts to help evaluate allergy and asthma biomarkers. The idea would be to gauge their use with the panel before they are used in the regulatory process, but it's unclear when these biomarkers could see an advisory committee meeting. It does seem clear, though, that stakeholders now understand the bar to be considered useful in clinical trials for an allergic disease. This is an interesting idea, especially as the FDA continues its advisory committee reform effort. Commissioner Robert Califf has argued that the committee should spend more time on drug development issues rather than application-specific issues. Do you all see this sort of thing as what kind of what Commissioner Califf wants debated during these meetings? Do you think this factors into kind of the reform effort?
I think it does. I mean, that's kind of why the comment sort of triggered. I guess, like, when I heard the comment, that was sort of the connection I was thinking of, like, oh, this sounds like sort of some of what the commissioner has talked about as he's thought about how to make different uses of advisory committees, particularly in thinking about ways to sort of hold more meetings that would be applicable to a variety of products, not just, you know, one product and whether it should or shouldn't be approved by now. So this seems maybe like following through with that idea and, you know, thinking about getting committees to weigh in on, you know, biomarkers, and that's something that could be help, you know, set a variety of development programs kind of on the right track. And then also maybe eliminate debates on the back end as you get closer to approval about that biomarker, because when biomarkers are used, you know, you sometimes get a lot of those debates as you get closer to approval of, okay, well, does this really, is this really a measure of what we think it is? Is it really, you know, is it really changing the disease course or so forth? So, I don't know, it certainly struck me as interesting in light of, you know, them thinking about their various different uses going forward for advisory panels. I don't think it's unprecedented either for FDA to think about something like this as an advisory committee use, but perhaps maybe they're thinking about it, doing more of it. It would be interesting too, although again, it may be not in line with what Caitlin was thinking, but it would be interesting if like you saw like advisory committees actually voting sort of yay or nay on a biomarker for use and, you know, as like a regulatory endpoint, but I'm not sure he wants to go that far.
That would be an interesting use of the committee, because usually, as you noted, there's sort of more discussion-based meetings for things like this, as opposed to sort of kind of the thumb up, thumb down on a product per se. I wonder if workshops might be a better use of FDA resources for these kinds of questions, as opposed to sort of kind of increasing their prevalence in advisory committees. You know, everyone talks about how complicated community advisory committees are. Obviously, the logistics behind workshops are equally so. But sort of it doesn't sort of kind of take on the same dynamic if it's a sort of more general discussion. But you also sort of lose that up or down vote on the endpoint as well, and as Caleb has noted, and we've covered that a workshop may have a more of an opportunity for lots of different input. He said he wants more advisors, and perhaps there is an opportunity for someone who would be otherwise unable to convene. I don't know if you could have a conflict of interest about an endpoint if you were the developer or publisher of an endpoint rubric, then maybe you would not be on that committee, but sure, you could give more of an input in a workshop. But it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor for the FDA to get more outside input on whatever it does, and the more formal it becomes, the easier it's it serves as a guidepost for drug companies for better or ill, in terms of sort of what kind of reception they might be able to expect at the at the agency as they go through their own development process.
I guess I wonder if, you know, especially if you start convening advisory committees with practitioners and who may not necessarily have the kind of deep research science background that some of them do have it, but some of them don't. You wonder if you start, you know, with some of the biomarkers, you might start confusing people with the science behind their development or the data associated with them. And, you know, we've seen this happen and we've talked about this on this podcast a lot, where, you know, advisory committees get the committee members get confused. They don't know how to vote. They keep, and then you end up with inconclusive decisions or, you know, lack of a good advice. And people are just kind of like throwing up their hands. I don't know what to tell you, some of these things can get kind of in the weeds, and you wonder if FDA, can at least at the advisory committee level can find the expertise that, would be able to give the advice that it wants on something like that.
maybe you create a biomarker advisory committee, and then the guest experts would be the people who are more focused on that disease area or something, you know, to get that if you need that. But the people, the core committee members are the folks that actually maybe are working more closely on sort of the type of science involved in, you know, biomarker sort of development and validating them and so forth. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not suggesting that there aren't people out there. I mean, there, you know, there's people at NIH, there's, you know, all over the place that could, you know, provide the advice that they need. I just, you know, you just ask yourself the, you know, the question, if they can they find those people? Can they get them on the committee? You know, are they, you know, and can they get the information and the advice they need out of the committee members that they're able to get? That's the question that I was asking. I don't know the answer to that. I know the expertise is there. I just don't know if FDA could get them in a room. Finally, we're going to look at international affairs. Japan's Pharmaceuticals and Medical Devices Agency, the PMDA, is planning to open a full-time office in the United States. The office will be in Washington, D.C., and will focus on attracting new early-stage drugs to Japan. The office could open in the five-year period from 2024 through 2028, and it will provide regulatory consultations in English rather than Japanese for free. The office also will be a hub for collaboration between the FDA and PMDA, as well as provide information on Japanese regulatory systems. In addition, PMDA plans on an Asian collaboration hub in Bangkok, Thailand, that would function as a training hub for pharmaceutical regulators in Asian countries. So the goal here seems to be to remind industry that Japan should be a primary market for development, but I think it's really interesting that they want to set up a U.S. office to do that. I'm curious what you all think.
I think it's great. I know that we all think that sort of more, you know, collaboration between regulators will sort of smooth things out for sponsors and sort of to kind of make it easier for you know, drugs to get developed. It's an open question as to sort of kind of whether this is sort of kind of a, you know, recruiting center to sort of kind of move programs out of the U.S. and, you know, people have you know, different opinions on whether that's a good thing or not, depending on their political valence, perhaps. But you know, the more that it helps sponsors understand the approval criteria in a new system, the more that system can operate smoothly, and you know, perhaps we can get some more alignment between the various regulatory you know, criteria across the globe, and that's going to speed drug development overall.
It seems, I think, Derek, you've maybe written about this or heard about this recently, like FDA having trouble, you know, sometimes recruiting people to go overseas and do work overseas for the FDA. So it seems helpful for the FDA to have, you know, people they want to collaborate with coming here and making their job of, you know, travel and logistics easier, rather than FDA having to, you know, have to do more work that, you know, pushes its staff overseas, given, you know, hiring and, you know, other logistical challenges. It seems positive for the FDA to have people coming to them.
Well, yeah, and, you know, Japan is always, along with the U.S. and Europe, is, you know, and, you know, Europe's EMA can been considered kind of like the big three, you know, kind of most mature regulatory agencies out there. So, you know, the EU has a mission here. It makes total sense that the, you know, that PMDA would have, you know, would want to have a presence here in the US. We have a presence in Europe as well. So, you know, it's an interesting, you know, development, and it makes complete sense. You know, I know this harkens back to my previous life in local newspapers, but we would write a lot about economic development efforts of these cities and states and counties and so forth. And they all had their own little economic development agencies, and they would be sending people all over the place to encourage companies to locate there or relocate there, and, you know, and so forth. So, you know, again, it's an economic development effort for Japan. It makes complete sense. I'm not sure I agree with Matt that this would necessarily, you know, kind of be a zero sum and take things away, necessarily risk taking things away from the U.S. and put them in Japan. I think it's more of a reminder that Japan is still out there, and, you know, we want you to work with us in addition to working with the U.S. and Europe, and not necessarily either or. But, you know, like I said, it's still an interesting idea. I'm really curious to see, you know, if this leads to increased harmonization with Japan and you know, addition, you know, any kind of regulatory changes, you know, along those lines. Well, that's all for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Sarah Carlin-Smith and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.